Well, this morning, as we come to Isaiah chapter 7, I think many of you have already heard, even in the reading of it, that most familiar Christmas verse, the virgin shall be with child. It is not strange to us, maybe during this time of year, to consider the weakness of children, God's way of entering into the world through humility in the incarnation, Christ born in Bethlehem, born of a virgin. And yet, we will find as we go through Isaiah's prophecy that God's intention of communicating to the world through children wasn't something that he just thought of on the first page of the New Testament. It was something that he had done through the holy prophets of old, and in particular, through the life of Isaiah. We will see as we can cover these few chapters in Isaiah that God is often communicating through little ones, through children. Their helpless nature, I think we all assume, is something that is helpful for us to remind us of the way of faith, to remind us that just like children who are dependent upon their parents and who are helpless to earn their own wages or get their own supplies, so too, when we see things rightly, are this helpless before the God of heaven and ultimately before history as it unfolds before us. And therefore, since we are helpless like these ones, what manner of people and what sort of lives ought we to live? Well, let us look at our text this morning as we consider this very question and as we consider what we're to be like or how we're to live as we wait for this day that Peter even spoke of this morning. You will notice as we come to Isaiah's prophecy, and there's a danger here in this morning's sermon, that a long history lesson is going to unfold and no one will know what we're talking about by the time we get to the end. So if you can hang with me for 5 minutes here, I promise I will not over inundate you with historical data. But it's very hard to ignore that there's this impending threat as soon as you open this text in Isaiah chapter 7. And this impending threat, as you can see, without being all that biblically savvy, has a whole lot to do with the kings of this world. You'll notice that particular repetition. Not only are there certain kings mentioned, their fathers are mentioned and their fathers before them, that were set this whole scene before us. And the way that we know what's going on in this historical setting is because all of the kings that have been mentioned in this text. You'll notice we're told that this text is taking place in the time of King Ahaz, ultimately the grandson of Uzziah. We know him famously from Isaiah chapter 6, in the year that King Uzziah died. Isaiah gets that wonderful vision in the temple of the Lord. So Ahaz here is the king of Judah. And during his reign, we are told that there are these other kings that are coming to give him pressure. One, the king of Syria, and also the king of Israel at the time. Now, that may read strange to us if we don't know our biblical history well. It would seem odd that a king of Israel is marching on Jerusalem in hopes of overthrowing it. And yet at this particular period in Israel's history, 200 years have transpired when the throne in Israel has been divided in two. There are two tribes to the south, Judah, which basically is formed of only of Judah and Benjamin. And all the other 10 tribes to the north are called Israel. And so this particular period, Israel is there to the north. They have certain fears and dangers that are surrounding them. And because of their fear, they join with Syria, this unbelieving nation, in hopes of coming together in a coalition to defend themselves from much larger enemies that surround them. Enemies like Assyria, which is different than Syria. So, well, keep your eye on the ball. And yet Judah stands alone. And they have been petitioned by Syria and by Israel to come join with them. And it would make a whole lot of sense, wouldn't it, for little brother to the south to join with big brother to the north. And then all three of them can join in a coalition to fight these greater powers to much farther north. And yet Judah to this time has not. And therefore, Israel and Syria are marching against God's people and ultimately against King Ahaz, this descendant of David and this heir to the throne of David. What is terribly, I think, telling about this time in Israel's history It's just how dramatic it is for those in Judah and how much pressure they are under. You will notice, even as the text reads, they're so dismayed at what is happening above them. It says the king himself, King Ahaz, and the heart of his people shook as trees of the forest shake before the wind. There may be a greater threat out there, this threat of Assyria, but the immediate threat is their own brothers to the north and Syria with them. And all they can think about is what is going to transpire in our near future. And what are we to do, being so small in comparison to these nations? And you'll notice this great descendant of David, his heart, it says, is swaying like a tree in the wind. He is shaken. Well, the next thing that we learn in this text, I think that's easy enough to kind of get the overall scope in verses 3 to 9, is that God is calling them to not be afraid in light of what's taking place. Somewhat easier said than done, I think we might imagine. But there are threats that are surely there, and yet God is calling them through the prophet not to give way to this sort of fear. And so you'll notice as verses 3 to 9 unfold, God calls the king, King Ahaz, to faith. And he's going to do so by sending Isaiah, but not just Isaiah. Oddly enough, God says, Isaiah, I want you to take your son with you and then go meet the king and have this conversation. Well, what is the message that is supposed to be spoken as Isaiah approaches with his son? It's not a difficult one. You'll notice these four commandments: be careful, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint. And then God goes on to ultimately mock the kings that are coming against Judah. Notice, to God, the reaction of Ahaz is foolish. Notice how Ahaz has been described. He comes and says, the whole house of David, their heart was swaying within them. And then we'll notice that King Ahaz is the grandson of Uzziah, who is ultimately, you know, a great-great-grandson of David himself. Why is it folly for the king to be afraid? Because he is the king of God's very own people. He sits on the very throne of David, a throne that has a promise over it that God says there will not fail to be a son of David on this throne from this time forth and forever. That Ahaz should know these things as a descendant of the great son David, this great king in Israel's history. And not only that, he should have within his own blood somewhat of the fortitude of David. I mean, David, who saw Goliath mocking the people of Israel, and though sorely outnumbered and sorely outweighed, David said, how dare this uncircumcised Philistine mock us like this? Doesn't he know that God is on our side? And yet we'll notice that Ahaz doesn't seem to have that sort of response at all. In fact, there's quite a few play on words in this text, as we'll see for this week and the weeks to come. And again, I don't want to make this like a Bible code that you couldn't know otherwise, but some of these things are too difficult to get around, to ignore. Ahaz's name itself basically means to grasp or to take hold of. And it is a shortening of a longer name, Jehoahaz, which means God has taken hold of. God has set his grasp upon you, that God is your defender. And yet you'll notice that doesn't seem to be Ahaz's default mode, that God is his protector. Instead, his name reflects how it will be used through the rest of the book of Isaiah, where God explains what's going to happen. What's going to happen? Your enemies are going to come and they will grasp you and they will take you away. And because Ahaz sees this threat of one coming to grasp him, notice what happens. He is seized with fear. The same word that's used for his name is something that will be used all through the book of Isaiah, that overcomes people when the enemies that surround them come upon the nation of Judah. So instead of being grasped by God, he's grasped by fear, because ultimately he sees that these enemies are coming to take hold of him. All of these reflecting his very own name. But notice, as God is trying to explain to him why he shouldn't be afraid, one, you're a son of David. Two, he says, I mean, look who it is that's coming against you. And, you know, the art of biblical trash talk may get lost on us, but God really is doing that. Notice what he calls it. if you want to use this insult, young people, for your sports teams, you smoldering stumps of firebrands. What God is saying there is, if you've ever, gone camping, you made a fire in your fireplace at home, as the fire begins to dwindle and ultimately the ashy, the kind of red hot log has rolled over to the side, it's kind of burning out its last embers. It's like a cigarette almost burned to the end. He's saying, don't you see, they were fierce at one point, but their time has come. Pretty soon they're going to be snuffed out completely. They're just sitting there smoldering, and that is a sign that their end is very near, which he goes on to say. In fact, their end is so near that it won't be 65 years from this date when Israel will be no more. So he says, there you are, you're afraid. You son of David, as you sit on your throne, there's no need to fear. All of your enemies are going to be undone, and you are king of the very people of God, which means I am your king. So don't be afraid. Don't give way to fear. Don't sway in the wind like a tree. God knows the plans of the enemies. And he even reminds Ahaz, I know what they want to do. They want to come down and they want to do all these things to you. But that is not my plan. My plan is to end their reign and their power altogether. Notice what he says. It will not stand. It will not happen. You couldn't use stronger language to reiterate to Ahaz that everything you're afraid of is a waste of all of your stress. It's not going to take place. I am the Lord who decrees the end from the beginning. And I am saying that these enemies you're afraid of need not be feared. They won't even be here any longer. In much longer. Once I have destroyed them, their plans will not be established. And notice then he calls the king to faith. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. If you will not stand in faith, you will not stand at all. Notice the choice is before him, and it seems obvious to us. We know how the story plays out, and so it's easy to say, in light of the message that Isaiah is bringing, believe God and put your hope in him. But remember, it's not only Isaiah who is present. Remember, he happened to bring his son with him to deliver this message to the king. And we may wonder, why would God add that fact, bring Shear Jashub with you? He doesn't say it just to throw in, color commentary on the event. We'll notice as we go forward in these chapters that Isaiah will declare this phrase, and you've heard this before quoted in the New Testament. Here I am and the children whom the Lord has given me. Isaiah is going to bring his kids along through these prophecies. And notice what he says his children are for. We, me and my children, are signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. So here's what Isaiah declares. Every time he goes and gives a prophecy, he himself is a sign from God, as well as the children that he brings with him. And you will notice his children will be named, and they'll even be named and renamed in these texts. God will keep changing one of their names just so that we know what he's supposed to mean when he arrives with Isaiah at a particular scene. Well, notice what is being spoken here then through Isaiah and his child as they come to meet Ahaz. What does Isaiah mean? Yahweh saves, which is exactly what Ahaz should have believed from the beginning. Even his name should have testified that to him. Jehoahaz, God has hold of you. Yahweh saves, Isaiah is saying by his presence. And then his son gives this strange message. A remnant shall return. Remnant theology all through the Old Testament speaks to that reality that after a war has taken place, after many have been devastated, that there is this small preserved group that God will not allow to be snuffed out in order to keep his promises to his people. And this is what Isaiah is saying to him through his son. A remnant will return to the land. Well, what's strange about that message? Well, one, they're already in the land. And God has just told them not to fear. So why would he say, Yahweh saves, and don't worry, a remnant will return? A remnant implies they're going to take a great beating at some point. They're going to be carted off, but they'll come back in due time. Especially when the message that follows from the mouth of Isaiah is, this will not stand, it will not come to pass. The message is a mixed one indeed. It's odd. God will save, and he will save from the present distress. What's the present distress? Israel and Syria. God's not going to let that stand. And yet, there's another problem that's on the horizon that Ahaz can't even fully consider or grasp yet. And when that problem arrives, God's promise is still sure. A remnant will return. Now, if you're still with me, and hopefully you are, this is where the text brings us. You may wonder, for instance, what this has to do with us. It's a very nice history lesson. It seems a bit distant and unrealistic. But think about how these verses will come later in the birth of Christ to a Jewish people in Judah, surrounded by a Roman government with no son of David on the throne. And we hear these sorts of prophecies, a virgin shall be with child and Emmanuel and so on and so forth. The same thing that Ahaz is being called to believe here, Israel will be called later to believe, that God can work in keeping his promise through a son of David, even when we can't see the way out, even when the enemies around us are so great, we can't imagine that God can deliver us. And so as the text continues in verses 10 and following, we see Ahaz has been called to faith. And yet we learn from this text that your faith must be in those things that can save truly if we're going to be delivered. You see, as we go through these series on Advent, that really is the question that's before us, not just this time of year, but at all times. Who do you trust? Where do you put your faith? And what is your hope in this present life? You'll notice that Ahaz is surrounded by threat. He's afraid. And God is calling him to a completely different way of life, even though he holds out before him, hey, the immediate threat's going to be destroyed, but there's this bigger problem that's coming that I'm not going to tell you anything about. But trust in me, Yahweh saves. Well, where do you put your hope when life presents difficulties that you can't see past? And who do you trust in the midst of those things? That is the question that is before us now in this text. It's before us now in this season. But it's always what's before us. When we look around us in our present culture, when we consider all the things that we face, whether they be family issues or national issues, these things are not distant from us. We are right here in this text. The God of Scripture is asking us, who will you trust in the midst of your present distress? A fool, we will learn, places his trust in that which cannot save, ultimately. Now, you may not see that on the face of this text, but Ahaz, you'll remember, in verse 10, the Lord says to him, ask for a sign, and I'll give you one. And Ahaz, in all of his spiritual pomposity, says, I don't need a sign, because I don't want to put the Lord to the test. Now, just a little piece of advice. The Lord ever tells you to do something, don't re-advise him and tell him why you don't need to do it. The Lord did not take kindly at all to Ahaz's feigning of some sort of spirituality. And you'll notice in response, he says to him, is it too little a thing for you to weary men that you weary God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, we read this text, and part of why I want to do this series is so that when we get to the Christmas story, we see what's really transpiring, why the Messiah is a big deal, that it's not somehow just sentimentalized and we go, oh, cute little baby in the manger and kind of God with us. And that's that. You'll notice where this text comes in biblical history. God has just said, ask for a sign. He says, I won't give you a sign. He says, you know what? Now you've worn me out. I'm going to give you a sign. A virgin shall be with child. And before this child can eat curds and so forth, you will know that what I've said will come to pass. Notice what's going to happen. Before the boy knows how to refuse evil and good, verse 16, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. That's good news. And the Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. You'll notice he says, the virgin shall be with child, and they shall call his name Emmanuel. You see, behind this text is the reality of who Ahaz is. He says, I don't want a sign from God. I don't need one. But the truth is told to us in 2 Kings. The reason why Ahaz is acting so nonchalant is that he's already gone behind, if you will, the back of God, if such a thing were possible. And he has reached out to Assyria, the biggest guy on the block. And he says, look, Syria and Israel are coming against me. So what I'll do is I'll form an alliance with you. We will be subservient to you if you will protect us from this particular threat at present. Now, what has God just said? Look, just wait. And within 65 years, these two will not even exist. And in the midst of his waiting, instead of doing what the Lord says, he reaches out to a different savior, a bigger army. And you'll notice as soon as this takes place, Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Notice what Isaiah says to him. Is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Now, notice up until this point, Isaiah has been saying, your God will do this. Your God will do this. As soon as he says, I refuse the sign, Isaiah changes the pronouns from Yahweh being your God, Ahaz, to now he says, he's my God, that you have deserted him by your answer. You're showing faithlessness by your answer. God is telling him to not put his trust in these foreign kings, for God could have saved him. But instead of trusting God, he trusts this other king. And then notice he says, here's the sign you're going to get. What could have been a sign of blessing. Now he says, the virgin will be with child, and behold, Emmanuel. Well, we all know from the New Testament. What does that mean? Well, God with us. But notice how God defines it. God says, by the way, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to come. I'm going to visit you. I'm going to destroy these two kings. And then I'm going to do such things in Israel as have never been seen before. How? By using the kingdom of Assyria to come and destroy you, to carry you off and to do devastation to the land of Judah. They could have trusted God, but instead they put their hope in this other. And notice then the results that before this child is even, knowing right and wrong, Assyria will come. The biggest bully on the block will be coming instead of these lesser kings. You'll get the worst army in the world, and the very thing they will trust in will ultimately be what brings their death. Now, hear me here. The ultimate thing that Judah put their trust in, when they lowered their trust from God himself to something on earth, was the thing that brought their ultimate destruction. Where they had placed their faith, where they had said, this will save me in my time of need, my health, my wealth, this powerful player on the national scene, Assyria, will be the thing that ultimately undoes King Ahaz. And so too it is for us. Notice what God says. I will use your hired hand and he will become your razor. Interesting language. He will shave your head. He will shave the feet, the hair of your feet. And he's also going to shave your beard off. All that to say, it's going to be devastating and humiliating to the nation of Israel. To have their beard shaved was an utterly humiliating thing. But not only that, they're going to be standing around, with shaved legs and so forth. And notice, all those who remain will only eat curds and honey, the same diet that was mentioned in verse 16. All this to say is that the only things that will be left are things produced by livestock and wild bees. There will be no produce, no grain, no oil, no wine. The whole land will be left in ruin. This king is without hope because of where he put his trust. But notice the text isn't written for him. It's written for the people of Israel. And there stands another as this text is being read. Shir Jashub, a remnant, shall return. Just because this man is faithless doesn't mean the promises of God will be undone to the house of David. That God will establish a kingdom. He will ultimately establish all that he has promised to his people. So now what are we to see when we look around? I mean, as you look around in this text in Isaiah, when they look around for the next years of their life, it will not look like they're receiving the blessings of God as the children of Israel. As this text is reread in Bethlehem years later about a child born in a manger, they will look around and there'll be centurions on every corner, and it will seem as if the plan of God has been utterly thwarted by the powers of this world. And even as it's read this morning, if we were to look outside this room and to evaluate life by the 6 o'clock news or by who controls what in your life, it would seem that the plan of God is utterly undone. But the call in the text is the same call that is always made to the people of God. To look past what is right before your eyes and look beyond to the God who has promised to be faithful. The God who does send his son forth into the world, born in a manger and ultimately ushered forth to a cross that testifies that you cannot trust what you see. A cross that looks like devastation and death. It looks like the utter undoing of all that God would want for his people, especially for an obedient Israelite like Christ. But of course, that death, that untimely and gruesome murder, is what sets all of God's people free. And we are given then that son as a sign to us for what we are to believe in this present day. How do we look beyond what is currently in front of us and trust in a God who says he will remain faithful to us? We look to the death and resurrection of Christ, knowing that though things are not yet what they will be, what is true is that we have a resurrected and ascended king, a son of David, who sits enthroned in heaven as Lord of all heaven and all earth, who is bringing everything in subjection under his feet. But there's not one iota of the creation that will be is currently outside of his authority that will not be under his full dominion on that last day when he returns. But you see, what gets us from here to there is trusting the promises of God, the invisible God, in the midst of the trials that are visible in this present world. And the call of the text is we either stand now in faith or we will not stand at all. You see, the question before us this morning is, who do you trust? In what do you trust? And not in some, feigned, visible, well, I believe in Jesus. But when things go awry in your life, where do you genuinely put your hope? Do you scurry to hurry up and go pray when things go wrong? Or do you go and check the bank account or call your most powerful friend or try to work up another job or another way out of the situation? Where is your hope truly? Because the glory of this king is that he tells us right now that all is well despite what you see. There's nothing out of place in God's world. Despite what you're viewing with your eyes, all of these things that seem so powerful are going to be vanquished in a moment. They're all just waiting to burn out. And the king that now sits enthroned will be made manifest in that day. And all who put their hope in him now will rule and reign with him then. So may we, even as we consider these texts for the next weeks, reprioritize our own lives and ask ourselves, where is our hope? In whom do we trust? And may we put that hope firmly on Christ, who has shown us through his life, death, and resurrection that he can be trusted and that there is nothing, genuinely nothing to fear in this present existence that God will not set right on that last day. Let us pray.